We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. People eat for all sorts of reasons. Being hungry is only one of them. In this hour of Focus, we're talking with Brian Wansink. He's a man who has been called the Sherlock Holmes of food. He says that our eating habits are shaped, to be sure, by our tastes, but our tastes are not formed by accident. He says that they're formed by family and friends, and certainly they're also formed by the people and the industries who make and sell our food. And he says that every day we make hundreds of decisions about food and eating without thinking about them at all. Hence, the title of his best-selling book, Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. Brian Wansink is the John Dyson Endowed Chair in the Applied Economics and Management Department at Cornell University, where he directs the Cornell Food and Brand Lab. And he's written many articles and books on eating behavior, including the book that I mentioned. He also, between 2007 and 2009, spent some time in Washington as executive director of the USDA Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion. Now, this was the agency that was responsible for developing the 2010 dietary guidelines and also promoting the food pyramid, something I'm sure people will be familiar with. Professor Wansink was on the faculty here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign for a number of years. He's going to be visiting next week, and I'll tell you about that later on. In the meantime, we'll be talking about some of the things that you will find in the book, Mindless Eating, Answer Questions. If you'd like to be a part of the conversation, just pick up the phone and dial the number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us email at will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are welcome. We just hope people can be brief and be on the topic, but otherwise, you can certainly give us a call. And Professor Wansink, hello.
David, it's great to be with you today.
Well, thanks very much.
I feel like I'm back home.
Kind of a homecoming, and it will be a literal homecoming next week. So we'll be, I'm sure people will be very happy to have you here on the campus.
Well, I'm psyched.
As a way of starting here, if it is the case that hunger is only one reason that people eat, and particularly if people are having some difficulty making good choices about how much they eat and what, well, if it's not just hunger, well, what else is it?
Well, what we found is that regardless of how tuned in we believe we are to our eating environment, the typical person ends up making over 200 decisions about food a day. Because it's not just whether you want Fruit Loops or oatmeal for breakfast, but it's whether you're going to have one bowl or one and a half or two bowls. It's what sort of milk you're going to put on it, how much sugar and stuff. But the crazy thing is, the majority of these 200 decisions aren't ones you're even aware of. They're kind of made on autopilot, or they're made sort of like almost below the point of literal consciousness. And it's in that space that all the stuff around us, whether it be what the person's doing next to us, or whether it be the size of a bowl, or whether it be the lighting in a room, all nudge us in one direction or another. They nudge us in the direction to eat too much or to eat too frequently in some cases. But the good news is we can also turn them around so we can use them to not just eat a little bit better, a little bit less.
Yeah, well, I think that that's one of the things that you aimed at doing, and I think a lot of people appreciate about mindless eating, is that what it does is that it first of all, gets you to think about these things, but then offers some solutions, some things that you can do, and they're not complicated at all. They're really all pretty simple things.
Yeah, and actually that's the objective of all the research we've done, and I started all this I did almost most of the research in mindless eating when I was at the University of Illinois. And we set up every study so that when it's over, we don't just know something, but we know what somebody can do about it, what, you know, we can do in our typical day. Hmm. Because to say, this we've detected is a real problem and say, thank you, I am through, does nobody a favor.
Well, this is just to say, to give one example, and it's really remarkable how simple some of these things are. One of the things that you found was that people can reduce the amount that they're eating do that in a very simple way simply by having smaller plates.
It's crazy. If you ask people how much is the right amount to serve themselves, nobody gives you what the USDA serving equivalent is of how much they should eat. They kind of go this much or that much. And if we give somebody a 10-inch plate, for instance, and say, hey, help yourself to as much pasta as you want, people will put about 4 ounces on that 10-inch plate. If we give them an 11.5 or 12-inch plate, they put 4 ounces on and they kind of go, wait a minute, that's not near enough. This looks like it's an appetizer. So what do? They plop another spoonful on, and on average that is about a 22% increase in calories if you just go up from plate size from 10 inches, which few of us have at home, to about 11.5 or 12 inches, which is what most of us have at home. But in both cases, people rate themselves as equally full because in both cases they ate what looked to them to be a full plate of food. Mm-hmm. And it's not just plates. It's bowls. It's serving spoons. It's everything.
Yeah, I think you also did some work on glasses, that is, drinking glasses, and the perceptions that people have about how much liquid there is in a particular glass, and the size and the shape of the glass can make a huge difference. And you can fool people into thinking that there's more in their glass than there really is, but simply by choosing a different shape of glass.
we did some of those original studies actually in Bevere Hall, and showed that if you give somebody about a 16 ounce glass that's tall and skinny, or a 16 ounce glass that's short and wide, people end up putting a lot more, about 30% more in the short wide glass than the tall skinny glass, because they're kind of looking at the height or the distance from the table, and they don't account for the width. But we put the real cool twist in that study. Went to Philadelphia and worked with about 86 Philadelphia bartenders, and showed that bartenders who are supposed to be experts at pouring even pour about 30% more or 28% more liquor or alcohol into short, wide tumblers than they do tall, skinny highball glasses. So I thought that was a really cool finding. Hmm. And, so I go and I tell people, I say, yeah, so you know what that means? And, unfortunately, most people can kind of go, yeah, if I go to a bar, get a short, wide glass. So not really wasn't really the response I was expecting.
Well, but I would think that the people in the business would think, oh-ho, we can change the glasses we serve, and people think they're getting more, and we can charge more or charge less or pour less or, something like that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I actually went and I visited a bunch of these big, casual dining chains and said, look, if you want a win-win way that you can save money, because liquor is a lot more expensive than ice cubes, you can save money and get people to drink less, okay? Here's what you do. Change the glass shape and glass size, or glass shape. And we found a number of these big chains that did it. I mean, it took a couple of years in some cases, but we found that eventually they started changing over some of their barware, so that the poor person is having two drinks isn't getting 2.6 without knowing it.
Yeah. Well, this all it gets to a question here early in the book in big, bold type. It poses the rhetorical question, is this a diet book? And obviously now today we know there are a lot of people who are concerned about their weight, and probably there are people who consume more calories daily. They consume more calories than they burn, and maybe more calories than they need. And so people are always looking for some kind of solution. The problem, though, with so many things that clearly are diets is that, maybe you can do it for a week. Maybe if you're really disciplined, you can do it for a month. But that most diets are not programs that people can actually live on. That's the problem. And so what you're doing here is you're modifying people's behavior. You're not so much telling them what to eat, but you're saying, but by doing a lot of these other things, that it will in fact influence it, at least maybe not what you eat, but how much.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's actually I think the Greek word for diet means something like way of life, or the Latin word way of life. I can't really remember what it means, but to me, diet, I think of it, I remember it as die with a T on the end. it's depriving. It's like you said, it's not sustainable for more than, you know, a week or most. And I know the people I've talked to have sustained a low-carb diet for a long time. Jeez, Louise, it seems to me like it's their halftime job is to think about their diet all the time and talk about their diet all the time. Now, in contrast, changing, I think that the solution to mindless eating is not mindful eating because, again, most of us have a life. You know, we can't spend every minute of our day saying, you know, am I full yet? Am I full yet? Am I full yet? Instead, it's a whole lot easier for most of us to simply change the cues around us so that we naturally end up eating a little bit less or a little less often without really knowing it, because then it's nothing that we really have to, you know, revolt against.
Well, and then once you're still taking advantage of the fact that people aren't thinking about it, but then you're making this one change, for example, like, you know, changing the size of plate. You do that once, okay, now you can forget about that. Because
yeah,
now
right.
You know, now this is the plate. Or if you say, you know, if you have trouble, as you do, if you have trouble snacking, take the snack stuff and put it in the highest, most remote, hard to get to cabinet that you've got. Make it hard to get to it. And once you have done that, then again, you can, you know, make it so that you actually have to make an effort to get that thing.
Yeah, because you're not telling yourself no. You know, mm-hmm. People say, you know, my solution to things is, I don't buy anything. You know, I never, ever, ever buy ice cream. You know, if it's not in the house, I'm not going to eat it. You know, that's really a good solution if you don't, on the other hand, go out and eat ice cream every time you go out to eat dinner. And what we find often, instead of telling yourself no, which affords the opportunity to push back and sort of compensate, telling yourself you can if you want it bad enough, works a lot better. So having ice cream at home, but having it in some far remote freezer in your basement where it's in the back and it's wrapped up in aluminum foil in an unrecognizable container. Hey, you know, if you want it bad enough, you can go get it. But more often than not, we'll say, you know, I think, oh, I'm not that hungry.
Mm. Let me just introduce again the guests for this hour, Brian Wansink. He is at Cornell now, was here at U of I for a number of years. He directs the Cornell Food and Brand Lab, and he's written a lot of articles and books that have to do with eating behavior, including one that has been a bestseller and continues to be very popular that offers a lot of concrete suggestions, as we have mentioned here. The title of his book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. And as he said, a lot of the research was done here at the University of Illinois. He will be on the campus, by the way, next week. He's going to give a talk on, this is Wednesday, I believe, April 6th, 103 Mumford Hall, talking on the subject, Modifying the Built Environment from Mindless Eating to Mindlessly Eating Better. And he'll be talking about some of the many causes of overeating. That's 4:00 in the afternoon next week, the 6th, and I'm sure anybody who would like to hear what he has to say should feel welcome. And of course, if you're interested in the subject, you can head out to the bookstore or the library and pick up a copy of Mindless Eating. Questions here, welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to just for a second go back to something, and I don't know if this is maybe more of a physiological question than it is mm-hmm. a psychological question. But you said that, you know, we don't want to go through the day constantly asking ourselves, am I full yet? Am I full yet? Well, what is it that influences whether or not we feel full? And if we're at the table, we're eating, we get to the point where we say, okay, that's enough.
Well, you know, it's a great question. And I think physiologically, I think there's a lot of research that's done that tries to predict how you know this. But I think from a much more useful standpoint, you can see our stomach as having three settings. Okay. On the far left, there's a setting that says, I'm starving. Okay. On the far right, there's a setting that says, you know, I'm so stuffed I couldn't eat another bite without exploding. But the vast majority, about 80% of that pie right in the middle, is I'm full, but I can still eat more. And when we're in that middle area, whether it be after the second helping of lasagna or whether it be after our sandwich and our chips and we're foraging for a cookie, that's where these cues around us, really nudge us in the direction of saying, am I full or am I not? Let me look around and look for cues. And there's a bunch of cues we use. This is a really cool study I did, and actually I did this. I was on sabbatical when I was at the University of Illinois. I was on sabbatical in France, and I asked 150 Parisians one week how they knew they were through eating dinner. Number one answer was, I know I am through eating dinner when I'm no longer hungry. And the second answer was, I know I'm through eating dinner when the food no longer tastes good. Now, those are internal cues that they're using to say, stop. About 3 months later, when I returned to Illinois, I went up to Chicago and asked 150 Chicagoans how they knew they were through eating dinner. Number one response, I know I'm through eating dinner when my plate is empty. Okay. The second one was, I know I'm through eating dinner when the TV show I'm watching is over. But in both of those cases, those are external cues that people are using to say, am I full yet? Am I full yet? Am I full yet? And most cues around us point us in the direction of eating more.
Yeah.
So we followed this up, and this was pretty cool. I had a buddy there. He's a professor in the nutritional science department, Jim Painter, who's now down in Eastern Illinois. And he and I did this refillable soup bowl study where we worked with a woman. Her name is Jill Norris. She teaches in the food science department there. And we drilled holes in the bottom of soup bowls through tables and connected this food-grade tubing in the bottom of a bowl through the table to this big cauldron of soup and brought people in to eat what they thought was lunch from a 6-quart soup bowl that will never end. And what we found, the typical person ate 73% more soup when it was refillable. And but when we'd ask them, hey, are you full? They'd say, no, how can I be full? I still have half a bowl of soup left.
And they didn't notice that that you were pumping soup in as they were taking it out off the top. It didn't occur to them, something's odd here. I'm eating it, but it never gets any less.
Well, you know, the thing is, we try to do these studies in as natural environments as we can. So we had brought these people in, and they were eating with others at the same table. So it wasn't like they were in a cubicle just staring at nothing but a soup bowl. You know, they were talking about what's going on, where they're going to go that weekend, how the team was doing. And so food, as it is in most contexts when we eat it, was really sort of a secondary importance to the social dynamics.
Yeah. This again goes to this wonderful point, this very basic point, and maybe, again, it's something people don't think about it, but the essential point being people will eat what you put in front of them. And that makes me think of the famous stale popcorn study that you did.
Yeah. That's actually one I did it both in Philadelphia and then also in Mount Prospect, just outside of Chicago. And what we find is if you ask people the last time they overate, why they overeat, most people, about 10% say some sort of mood-related thing, like they're bummed out or whatever. But about 50% of the people will say the last time they overate was because they were really hungry. And about 38% say the last time they overate was because they were really, really, the food was really, really good. And we decided to figure out what can we do if we take people who just ate dinner and we give them food that's terrible. And what we gave them was popcorn that we'd bought and we'd left sitting out in a sterile lab at Illinois over in the National Soybean Research Labs building. Left it out for 5 days until it was stale as styrofoam. And when people came into this theater to see this movie up in Chicago, we gave them either a medium size or a huge bucket of this nasty stale popcorn. And found that during the course of the movie, nobody would, when they ate the popcorn, nobody would eat more than one bite at a time because it's terrible. But from 1 minute to the next, they'd forget that it was terrible and they'd take another handful. And we found that the people ended up eating 44% more popcorn if we simply gave them a large bucket, even though they weren't hungry and even though the food was terrible.
Yeah. Well, maybe, again, it goes back to I'm thinking again about the small plates. And about if people will eat what you put in front of them, then particularly, say, if you have a family and you're concerned about what they eat, then one of the things that maybe you want to do is make up the plates in the kitchen, put the food on the plates, bring them out, put them down. Don't let people serve themselves and have that be what's on the plate is what's on the plate. Have some control over what that is, and then that way people will they'll eat what's on the plate, but if you have some control about what's on the plate, then you have some control about what they're eating.
Yeah, you're right on the nose. Yeah, that's perfect. You know, and giving people the latitude of having more if they want to is great, but it's a whole lot better if they've got to get up and get it than if they can just reach one foot in front of them, get their thirds or fourths of a lasagna. We did a study out here that looked at this. We invited a bunch of families in for dinner, and we either had the serving bowl sitting right on the table or back just 6 feet away on a counter or on the stove. And one thing we find is that, in general, guys are a lot faster eaters than women are. And we just kind of wolf it down.
Yeah, I've noticed that, yeah.
Okay. And so what happens is that, you know, 3 minutes into most, or, you know, 5 minutes into most meals, the guys are kind of done, kind of tapping their foot, and the kids and the wife are kind of still eating. So what's a guy do? I'm not just going to sit here and be bored. I'm going to take something else. And so they'll have seconds and thirds and fourths. And we found that simply by moving these serving bowls of pasta or whatever we were serving, leaving it on the stove or on a side counter, what it reduced was the amount that the average guy was eating by about 29%. I mean, that's huge. You know, because simply you'd say, hey, do you want seconds? Yeah, I'll go up and get seconds. But then when it came time for thirds, it's like, I'm okay. I think what happens is that 6 feet difference gives you pause to say, am I really that hungry? And a lot of times you just answer no.
That's amazing that just that 6 feet would make that much difference. Maybe that also says we need more exercise if we think walking 6 feet to get a second on pasta is a big deal.
Well, it had a whole lot less influence on women. I think it only decreased how much they ate by about 9%. And it's largely because they're not taking seconds and thirds as much as guys are.
Yeah. Well, if one of the things that you mentioned, for example, with the stale popcorn, part of the reason that maybe works is that people are watching the movie, they're not thinking about what they're eating, and maybe that's also a reason why some people would say it's not healthy, for a variety of reasons, to be eating in front of the television, watching television, Maybe you're concentrating on what you're looking at. You're not really concentrating on the food. And maybe even if, we talk about how good a thing it is to have families eat together, because there's people talk and there's great interaction and it's a great opportunity for togetherness. But that I think what you really want, you do want people to focus on the food. And if you're doing some things to try to make it look good and taste good, then you want people to give it some attention, you know, pay attention to what they're eating and think, boy, this is really nice, because one would hope is the better it is, then that will also help people feel satisfied by having less.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, we're doing this kind of cool study here. We just actually finished up. We're getting ready to ship it out, but we call it Cooking with Kids. And the idea is, a lot of people say, you know, one way to get kids to eat better and to eat healthier is to cook with them in the kitchen. And people just tend to assume that that's true, because the kids will pay more attention to food and stuff. And what we find is that when we compare the families that do that and families that don't, you know, the kids do tend to eat more like they're more likely to eat a salad. They're more likely to eat an extra side dish. They're more likely to drink milk instead of pop. But they're also more likely to eat a dessert during the meal, and they're more likely to eat bread. So it's not quite a wash, but it's not as clean cut as you thought. But the cool finding we found was exactly what you said, is that when they rate the family dynamics, every objective measure of family dynamics improved when people ate together. Even though they didn't eat as dramatically better as we had hypothesized, they were more likely to all sit at home until everybody had finished. They ate more meals a week together. They were much more likely to eat without a television or radio on. They're more likely to, you know, do things like say grace and things like this, too. And so the social kind of dynamic was dramatic compared to what we were expecting. So you were right on target.
Mm-hmm. Our,
as for the TV, the TV thing is kind of interesting too. You know, we find there's a number of reasons that people overeat in front of the TV set, but the two biggest ones are people lose track of how much they're eating because, like you said, they're paying attention to the show. And second of all, we find that people will tend to pace their eating relative to the show. They'll eat faster during faster shows, and they are more likely to stop when they hit the end of a show. They use that as a cue as to when to stop.
Our guest in this hour is Brian Wansink. We're about midway through here. Maybe for anyone who might have just tuned in, I should mention who he is and why we're talking to him. He teaches at Cornell now. He is the John Dyson Endowed Chair in the Applied Economics and Management Department at Cornell. He also directs the Cornell Food and Brand Lab, and he has written hundreds of academic articles, books on eating behavior, and he is also the author of a book that has done very well, got a lot of good practical advice in it for people to be more conscious of how they eat. The title of his book is Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. He was on the faculty here at University of Illinois for a number of years, did some of the research, in fact, that led to that book here at the University of Illinois. We talked about some of that. And I do want to mention that he will be the keynote speaker at the 2011 U of I Nutritional Sciences Graduate Student Association Nutrition Symposium, and this is happening next week. I'll be talking on the topic, Modifying the Built Environment from Mindless Eating to Mindlessly Eating Better. This is the 6th. Next week, I think that's Wednesday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, room 103 of Mumford Hall, and he'll be talking about the various causes of overeating. So I do think that is open to the public. As far as I know, it's open to the public. And, of course, if you would like to read the book, Mindless Eating, that's an easy thing to find. You can go out and get the book. And questions here are welcome, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that I'm sure that professional chefs and cooks know is that the way that food is presented, how you arrange it on the plate, how things look, you can't make bad-tasting food taste good just by the way it looks. But that certainly we know that enhances the experience. The whole business of the atmosphere in which you eat, how the plate looks, that's going to make a big difference to how you appreciate that food. And I guess I wonder if you feel that you have learned some things about presentation that will play into what we're talking about.
Oh, man, it is crazy how much this influences how much we evaluate food. But what's even crazier is that there's not a person in the world who's willing to acknowledge that they are influenced by these things. I'll give you an example. In Bevere Hall, this buddy, Jim Painter, who was a professor there, and I did a study where he was trying all these new healthy recipes in Bevere Hall. This is maybe in like the year 2000, but nobody is eating them. And so we tried something where we would have it on the menu with its normal name, you know, seafood filet. We take it off for a couple weeks. We put it back on. And we call it succulent Italian seafood filet. You know, basically, it's a fish stick. And what we found is that whenever we gave things descriptive names, sales just increased for the entire week for that item for about 28%. And afterwards, after people would take it, we'd have them rate the flavor. And then we'd ask them these crazy questions like, they'd rate the flavors better. They'd rate the Bevere's being more trendy and up to date than if they had eaten a version without a label. And they even rated the chef, who back then was just a normal hourly graduate student or something, as having more years of foreign culinary training. But we found that anything that biases how good you think a meal is going to taste has a dramatic impact on it.
Yeah.
We found that giving people a nice brownie on a paper plate or on a napkin and saying, hey, what do you think of it? How much would you be willing to pay for it? They go, it's pretty good. I'd be willing to pay about 70 cents. You give them the same brownie on a piece of china and say, what do you think? They go, unbelievable. How much would you pay? A buck and a half. Exact same food. And I have like tons of dinner parties. I had one last night. I'm going to have one for the bunch of people tomorrow. And I'm not a very good cook, but there is no denying that that food is going to be unbelievably presented. There's going to be candlelight. I'm going to have indirect lighting. It's going to be a nice tablecloth. And people are going to think it's just off scale.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because their expectations lead to that. And what we find, interestingly, is that the first thing a person tries disproportionately biases the entire rest of the meal. The first thing a person eats.
Hmm.
And I'll give you an example. We did this Jill North, who's still at Illinois right there, she and I did this really cool study in the Spice Box. And if you had a chance to eat at the Spice Box?
I must admit, shamefully, I have never eaten at the Spice Box.
Because I'll buy your next dinner there.
Okay. Because I know that many people have, and they say that the food is really good, and it's a nice thing that, you know, that's where people go to try to learn the culinary skills, and I am told that the food is really nice. So I'm sorry to say, no, I've never been there.
Oh, it's really, really cool, too. But we used to do a lot of studies there.
Mm-hmm.
Back when Jim Painter was there, but this one we did, we called it Fine as North Dakota Wine. We invited people came in for dinner, and it was like in a February, it's a snowy February. But what we had done is we had ordered all these cases of this Charles Shaw wine. It's this cheap kind of $2 wine that they used to call $2 Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
And we took all the labels off and put labels on that said it was either a wine from California, a place known for wine, or the label said it was from North Dakota, a place not known for wine. And we didn't care what people thought about the wine because we know the labels make people think wine tastes better and worse. But we wanted to see how it affected the rest of their meal. And so when people came there, we gave them complimentary wine, told them it's from California or North Dakota, even though it was the same wine. And people who thought they were drinking California wine, they stayed longer, about 10 minutes longer. They rated their food better. The wine is better. They made reservations to come back. People who thought they were drinking North Dakota wine, they didn't eat as long. They rated the wine as less good. The food is less good. And when we asked them if they wanted to, kind of make reservations to come back again, they weren't very likely to do it. But one guy, a store member, said, we said, would you like to make reservations to come back? He goes, oh, no. He says, you know, I'm really busy for the rest of my life.
How about never? Never good for
you? That's right.
Fargo. That's the problem.
Yeah. Well, so the first thing you taste even during a meal, whether it be the appetizer, I think has the same biasing effect on the rest of the meal. So if it's a bad appetizer, you're kind of handicapping yourself, even with the beef Wellington that's going
to
follow.
All right. We have a couple callers here. Let's go to them. We will start with someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I realize that the focus of your talk today is food psychology, and I'm wondering, since I've heard that people can be super tasters or average tasters or even sometimes non-tasters, whether or not their individual response to food goes along with your test results, or whether it's influenced individually by their taster status. And I'll hang up and listen to you talk further, but I'm curious about the whole super taster, non-taster thing. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Yeah, well, thank you very much, Emma. That's very true. And actually, I used to live on Delaware Street in Urbana, so it's good to hear an Urbana voice. Well, the thing about the designation of super tasters and, on the other extreme, non-tasters, it's a very easy way to categorize people based on how many taste buds they have. And if you've got a huge, huge number of taste buds per square centimeter, you're loosely labeled as a super taster. If you don't have very many, you're loosely labeled as a non-taster, and then in between is where most of us lie. Now, you might think, and a lot of foodies like to believe they're super tasters, but I'll tell you, in 95 times out of 100, they are not super tasters. They're much more, they have a more average number of taste buds. Because the problem with being a super taster, the problem with having tons and tons of taste buds, is that a lot of things taste really aversive to you, like things that are a little bit bitter, like broccoli, are horribly bitter to you. Okay, things that maybe are a little bit sweet to a normal person are horribly sweet. And so in some ways, the real super foodies in the world are probably not going to be the super tasters of the world, because there's too narrow of a band of foods that they really find appealing. You know, they're going to find wine just terribly tannic, you know, and they're going to find coffee, they want it weak or they want it not at all. So that's kind of what goes on. But we find that we tend to choose foods then that are the normal run-of-the-mill foods and not giving somebody anchovies and stuff. But we'll find that most of these people end up being responding in similar ways, even though they might be super tasters or non-tasters or normal tasters.
Okay, let's go to Danville, line two. Hello.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I am really enjoying this topic, and I am 37 years old, and probably for 37 years, I've had an issue with overeating. And just a couple things that you said have just really, really hit home for me over the past year. I did minimize our plates. I changed all the plates out, and they're very small now, and that is definitely helping. But one thing that has been ingrained in me is you don't want to waste food. If you have something that it really only tastes good the first day, you don't want it to go to waste. You don't want to throw it away. So you feel like, I must eat it all. The family must eat it all. We cannot have this tomorrow. Or no one's going to eat it tomorrow. No one's going to eat it for the rest of the week. So we have to eat it now. And I try not to cook as much, but then my kids will say, well, I'm still hungry. And I'm like, well, there's none left, you know, because you won't eat it. So I really would like a solution. Even if we go out for fast food, and you know fast food prices are huge, you don't want to waste it. You don't want box of fries to just sit there. You just don't. What solutions do we honestly have for that, for those issues?
I was raised in Iowa in sort of farmland, and I don't think I've ever seen my mother or father, 85 years old, ever leave anything on their plate.
Yeah.
We did this cool research a while back where we looked at how recipes changed over time. We looked at 70 years of the joy of cooking and analyzed every recipe that was common across those seven or eight different editions, and found that the typical serving size of recipes in the joy of cooking have increased 43% in calories per serving, because it's more butter, more sugar, added more stuff. And, you know, the easy solution to something like that is that you and I are making stuff for our families that is a lot more caloric than what our parents made for us. One solution is to get rid of the temptation to have just a little bit more. And one thing that we do in our house is when I make something, let's say it's a casserole or something, I cut it exactly in half, and I put half it in there, and I serve half of it, and I put the other half in the freezer. I put the other half in the refrigerator. Then we eat. And I find that typically we would eat 60% of it. We'll eat 50% of it, which is all there is, and be happy. And if somebody says, I'm still hungry, it's like, oh, good, there's more in the freezer. You can go spoon it out and microwave it. And that doesn't happen a whole lot. And the nice thing about that is all of a sudden, it's not leftovers, because you're taking the other half, you're freezing it, and it seems really good 2 weeks later when you thaw it out again.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think that might, now again, I've never done studies on just serving half a portion, but we have done a lot of things on how size makes a person believe they're full. Mm-hmm. If you finish something, you believe you're more full than if there's something still left on a plate, in a dish. So I think that's worth trying.
Okay. If you finish your half portion. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for your nice comments.
Well, thanks. Okay. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus, and our guest is Brian Wansink. He teaches at Cornell. He directs the Cornell Food and Brand Lab, also was here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, for a number of years. He's done a lot of writing about eating behavior including the book Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. And he'll be visiting here next week to talk about some of these things. And questions continue to be welcome here as we work through the rest of the hour. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Get some other callers here in a second. I do want to ask you about the problem of going out to eat, which some people do for convenience, and you know that sometimes is helpful, and some people do for fun, and that's fine too. But I think that also some people would argue that we have had a real serious portion inflation when it comes to restaurant food, and maybe also, you know, people go to restaurants and they offer you all this food, and you think, well, gosh, look at everything I'm getting for my money. Appetizer, main course, and dessert. And they're, you know, people bring out slabs of cheesecake that would feed a family of four for a week. So, you know, what do you do in a situation like that?
Well, there's a couple things going on in restaurants. And one is, yes, portions have gotten bigger because there's, and that's good. I mean, nobody wants them to get smaller for your money, and that's a great thing about competition. Bad thing for diets, but good thing about value per dollar. But the other thing that's going on is, and we did this really cool study called the Muck Subway Study, where we compared people eating at McDonald's and Subway and found that people eat more calories at McDonald's, on average about 900 calories versus about 650 at Subway. But at McDonald's, they knew they were kind of eating indulgently, and they estimated that they'd eaten a lot. At Subway, people, even though they ate 650, would say, yeah, I think I ate about 300. It's like, really? I mean, where do you come up with that? And they'd kind of go, oh, well, you know, it's a healthy sandwich and stuff. And it's like, well, did you have a cookie? Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I was eating a healthy sandwich, so I could, you know, I could have that cookie. Did you have chips? Yeah, yeah, but they're the low-fat chips. Yeah. Did you have mayonnaise? Yeah, but I think it's low-fat mayonnaise, but I'm not really sure. Did you have cheese? Yeah, but I think cheese is included in the calories. And so it's all these incremental things when we eat out. And, you know, if you look at eating dinner out, well, you're not eating that big entree. You're probably also eating 2 to 3 pieces of bread before it comes. You're having, maybe a glass of wine or a soft drink, or you might be having dessert. You're having a side order or something. You're splitting an appetizer with the person next to you. And one of the easy solutions to doing this is not what most people do, which is they say, okay, whenever I go eat out, I'm going to eat tasteless chicken. No, and then I'm going to announce to everybody I'm on a diet and ruin their evening too. No, the better thing to do is to say, look, I'm going to order whatever I want to for my entree, but in addition to that, I am going to limit myself to only two other things. It could be one piece of bread, or it could be two pieces of bread, or it could be some wine and an appetizer, but it's not going to be two pieces of bread, an appetizer, wine, and a latte afterwards. And giving yourself the freedom to say, look, I can take whatever two items I want the most, is very liberating to people because it doesn't make them feel like they're sacrificing.
We have a couple of other callers. We have 6-7 minutes left, and we'll go next to Congerville, line one. Hello.
Yeah, this may not help people who live in town much, but I found the best thing for feeling or for not feeling guilty about throwing away food, well, not throwing away food, but excess food. I have a couple of pot-bellied pigs, and I feel so bad about feeding them the same stupid green pellets every day that virtually all the scraps and waste or stuff that looks a little not questionable, stuff that I really don't want to eat goes out to them, and I feel like I'm being a great benefactor to those poor little buggers. And, having an animal who will eat the food greatly reduces the amount of guilt at not eating it myself.
Hmm. Maybe not necessarily good for the health of the animal, but I wouldn't know.
I like it. I like it. We can call this the feed your pig diet. How's that?
Yeah.
I like it. Oh, excellent.
All right.
Well, thanks a lot for your
thank
call.
You. It makes me think of the old thing about how the family dog is underneath the dining table and the kids sneak the stuff they don't let. The Brussels sprouts get fed to the dog, which may not necessarily be all that good for the dog, assuming the dog will even eat the Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, the lima beans, yeah.
Exactly. Right. let's see. Savoy is next. This is line two. Hello?
Hi.
Yeah, hi.
I'd like to to address also the issue of throwing away food and that caller who called, because I have two small children, and so I'm constantly dealing with portion sizes and cooking and having lots of leftovers, because kids are picky eaters. And so when they eat everything on their plate and we run out of food, which is rare, and there are no leftovers, I consider it a success. And if my kids complain that they're still hungry, I say, okay, if you're still hungry, you can make yourself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And if they really are hungry, they will go ahead and do that. If they aren't hungry, if they really are full, they won't. And as for the excess food, I just say right now, it's got to go. And I'm not going to let, I'm just going to let go of the guilt. I don't have to be perfect. I just have to be good enough. And so those two things help me out with the, excess food and so on. So, but it's a process. It's an ongoing battle.
Well, the second thing you talked about, you are being perfect by doing that. We did a really, really neat study a short time ago looking at what are the consequences of the Clean Plate Club. And we did this with four-year-old kids. We found four-year-old kids whose parents insisted they clean their plate the night before were more likely, poured 44% more pre-sweetened cereal for breakfast the next day, and they're more likely to take an extra dessert at lunchtime at the daycare center when we gave them a lunch buffet. And what's crazy about that is within about 3 hours of analyzing this data, everybody in my lab who had kids went, holy cow, if this is what happens when I tell little Audrey she's got to finish her vegetables night after night after night, I am never going to tell her to finish her plate again in my life. And I know from that day forth, I changed the way that I feed my kids.
It's not just cleaning the plate that I was referring to, but actually not having leftovers. And that when it, referring back to what you said, if they perceive that there's nothing left over, they think they're still hungry. But if they know there's stuff left over, they, will may eat more. You know what I mean? So that's why
sure.
I say if it's all finished, I'm like, yay, we finished it. And if you want more, if you really are hungry, then, you take the initiative and here's your choice. So
perfect,
anyway,
perfect.
Thank you so much for an interesting topic.
Thank you.
Thank you. A lot of the cool studies we did in pizza restaurants were actually done in Savoy. It used to be called the Pizza Garden. I don't know if it's still called that. It's kind of where the theaters are down there. We did a lot of really cool all-you-can-eat studies down in that pizza restaurant. It's an all-you-can-eat buffet. It's really cool. So I have warm, fuzzy memories of Savoy.
Savoy. Got a couple of minutes left here. We'll try to get at least one more person here. Champagne, line 3.
That's me?
Yes.
Okay. I want to give you a hypothesis for your next project.
Perfect.
I've noticed that if you stop eating before the hunger pangs go away, within about 15 minutes or even less if you get up and do some exercise, that those hunger pangs do go away even though you haven't eaten any more. So it's like there's this time lag between the time the food hits the stomach and the time it sort of gets to react with the lining of the stomach and do whatever it does to produce this sensation of satiation.
Now, that's a tremendous observation. And, what it might correlate with is that's also the length of time it takes food once it drops through your mouth to hit your small intestine where it starts getting, your intestines where it starts getting absorbed.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There could be some real physiological
yeah.
Backing to that.
So anyway, I was thinking you could set people down to a dinner in a restaurant and then pull the fire alarm. And,
I love it.
And then compare it with the people when you don't pull the fire alarm.
I love it.
Them
that's
and
it.
Ask
that's
them
it.
Whether they're full, and see how many of them want to come back and finish their meal. And stuff like that.
That's right. Or how many ever come to the restaurant again? Yeah, that's it. Hey, that's very, very neat. Very neat. That'd be fun. It'd be fun for the experimenters, not the eaters.
Radical experimental design. Yeah. I thank you for the call. We're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish. I'm sorry. I think we have one more caller I just can't take. Maybe just one more thing because you deal with it in the book, particularly for people who are trying to lose weight. It seems a good thing to remember that even if you're doing the what seem to be the right things, if you are getting exercise and you're following good sort of mainstream recommendations about what constitutes a healthy diet, if you do those things, chances are you will lose weight, but you have to be patient. It's going to, you know, healthy weight loss actually should be quite gradual.
Yeah, I mean, as a rule of thumb, I believe that the faster it comes off, the faster it comes back on again. But the slower it comes off, the more you're likely to get the right blend of stuff burning off. It's not just water and muscle you're losing, it's actual fat. And also you're setting a pattern in life that has the best chance of continuing on.
Well, there, I guess we'll have to finish up. I do want to, again, mention for benefit of people here in Champaign-Urbana that our guest, Brian Wansink, who is now at Cornell University and was here for a number of years, will be back on the campus to give the keynote speech in the 2011 U of I Nutritional Sciences Graduate Student Association Nutrition Symposium. And could they make the title any longer of the event? And he'll be speaking about modifying the built environment from mindless eating to mindlessly eating better. That's next week, April 6th, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He'll be talking about the many causes of overeating. And for anybody, if you'd like to read about some of the research that he's done, some of the things we've talked about, and there's much more here of value, you can go out and look at the book, Mindless Eating, Why We Eat More Than We Think. It was published in 2006 and should still be easily available. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, thanks a million, David. This was a lot of fun.
All right. And also thanks to Bert Odom Reed. He's the engineer who is on the other end of our high-quality connection there at Cornell.